Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. Well, I'm really excited today to bring you a fashion island hero of sorts. Now, I know she'll hate me for saying that, but Marcy Summers is respected by so many of us for what she's created as a social and environmental activist. She has done a project, we'll talk about it, in Indonesia that stands out as an example of what is possible in a global environmental landscape that can look so bleak. So knowing that Marcy's in town, I grabbed her, invited her here, and we're going to talk not only about the work that she's done over the years, but how she's sustained herself, doing work that is hard work, creative work, uncertain work, and done it over time. So Marcy, it's been a delight. I've been looking forward to this, and thank you so much for coming by the studio.
Oh, thank you so much, Sally. I'm delighted to be here, honored to be here. And it's just a great privilege. So thank you.
A lot of people on the island know your background, and I'm just going to give some highlights because I didn't know that you're a fourth generation native of the islands of Puget Sound. Which islands?
Well, I say islands because I actually grew up on Bainbridge Island before defecting to Vashon. So.
Yeah, we'll allow that. You know. Yeah.
But yeah, my grandparents. And
this is interesting. You have a bachelor's in comparative religion from Harvard, mm-hmm. a master's in wildlife ecology and conservation, which is already an interesting combo, from the University of Maine. And you're currently working on a PhD in conservation biology at Newcastle University in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
We'll have to talk about that because going back and getting your PhD at, when you're not a spring thing anymore.
That's, at 60.
At
yes.
60.
Right.
That's interesting, but I happen to believe that that's the best time for it.
Well, fortunately, I'm finding the same thing. I'm having much more fun than I thought I was going to.
You've also been the recipient of numerous awards for leadership and innovation, including the Switzer Foundation's Fellowship for Environmental Leadership. And I love this. And the Maine Governor's Award for Environmental Excellence. Because I did not know this, but one of your roles has included being mayor of the town of Hampton, Maine.
Yes. It feels like another life ago, but yes. In my 20s and early 30s, I lived in Maine, and I got involved in, our town hosted the largest commercial landfill in eastern Maine, and I got involved in a citizens group that had some concerns about what was going on at the landfill there, and one thing kind of led to another, and I ended up being elected to the town council, and then as mayor, and then things kind of went from there.
You weren't tempted to run for senator. We could have used you.
Actually, I was asked at the time if I wanted to do that. But one of the great insights that I gained in being mayor was that although I enjoyed that and I enjoyed being in a position where I could make a difference, what I really loved was the environmental issues and the conservation issues. And when you're an elected official, you have to be a jack of all trades. You have to deal with what comes down the pike. And I just didn't care about cable TV franchises. And what I really wanted to do was be an advocate for the things I really care about. So that made it easy to say no, because I knew that my proper path led in a different direction.
Right. It sounded like a good launch to get your feet wet and then identify what you really loved and begin to pursue that. And then along the way, you've been a farmer, baker, gardener, single mom of two, and a senior scientist for a large international conservation non-governmental organization or NGO. Can we use the name of it? Is that all right?
Sure. Yeah. It was the Nature Conservancy.
You had mentioned that, because the other thing about Marcy is she did a stellar talk at the Vashon Center for the Arts about a month ago. And so we got to learn a lot about your background and fabulous project with the Topotika Alliance. Mm-hmm, did I say it right?
Yes.
In Indonesia. Yeah, Indonesia. Well, take me back. Let's go back to your days as senior scientist with the
Nature Conservancy.
Mm-hmm. That was a steady job, right?
Yeah.
And you were, I assume that you were traveling the world. Was that a piece of it?
Well, I was assigned to the Asia Pacific program, so, and mostly Indonesia. So my focus at that time was just that part of the world, mostly Indonesia. And I appreciated that. I really like to go deep and get to know smaller areas well.
What led you to create the Topotika Alliance? And were you still working with the Nature Conservancy when you did that?
Well, it all happened totally by accident, Sally. When I was with the Nature Conservancy, I was in charge of a scientific assessment of the whole island of Sulawesi, which is one of Indonesia's major islands. And as part of that, I spent a lot of time there. And one time when I was out in a remote corner of Sulawesi, I just sort of stumbled upon one of the last best nesting grounds for this endangered bird called the Malayo bird. And I'd been asked to give a presentation in the local village there about Sulawesi wildlife. I did that. And then I also sort of followed it up by letting people know that what they had there was really special. For them, it was just their wallpaper. They'd had it all along. You know, they took it for granted. They were taking every egg that was laid at the nesting ground. And they were also noticing that the population was declining. And I just kind of helped them connect the dots to think about. And I asked them at the time, you know, do you ever leave any eggs? And they said, well, no, you know, why would, if I don't take it, somebody else is going to take it. So no, we don't leave eggs. And I just kind of invited at the end of this presentation, invited them to think about where that was going to lead. Do you realize that if you keep taking every egg, this bird will be extinct here just as it is almost everywhere else? They hadn't really thought about it that way. And so when they were invited to think about it that way, they realized, hey, you know, and I said, is that what you want? Because that's the boat you're on. And a bunch of people after the presentation came up to me and said, no, that's not what we want. Will you help us figure out some kind of a conservation program? So it just began as a very, or I said, sure, of course I said, sure, you know. And I thought we might have a few meetings and we'd talk about it a little bit. And I had no idea at the time that it was going to actually lead to a real project getting launched and then, you know, much less a whole organization. And here we are nearly 20 years later with a whole slew of things that we do.
Well, I want to spotlight before we go on and learn about that progression. That was pretty, it would seem like really monumental that you were able to bring that kind of awareness by documenting what was happening in the nesting grounds. Because I remember when I was studying systems theory some years ago, there was the whole thing about the tragedy of the commons.
Yes.
Where everybody leaves their cow in the common area and nobody wins because the commons get eaten away and then none of the cows can survive. Whereas if the community comes together and talks about solutions, you can figure out what's best for all. But Absolutely. That requires systems thinking. And that's in short supply sometimes in this world.
Yeah.
But you got natives, you got the folks in the island thinking about that with your presentation.
I have found that, and I should say that what was happening there was what's happening everywhere. You know, they were not special. The Malayo is critically endangered and nearly gone. And the reason is because what was happening there, it was happening everywhere. People just take the eggs, as you say, you know, they don't really think about it as, oh, you know, if we keep doing this, if I keep doing this and everybody else keeps doing it, then 20 years from now, they'll be gone. People don't think that way. And so we just all keep on this slide. And what I found, though, is that most people, when you invite them to remember their connection to nature, when you mostly they just didn't even think about the bird. You know, it's actually very important culturally. It's very iconic. It's sort of like the bald eagle for Sulawesi. It's the mascot. You see it on emblems, on brand names, all over the place. But most people don't think about it very much. They certainly don't think about it with respect to their own behavior and how it affects the bird. So when invited to do that, most people actually really do love nature. They love the nature that's around them. They love the birds that are in their homeland. They love the things that are part of their identity as citizens of that place on the planet. And so really all I did was just remind them of that and invite them to think about it that way. And when you do that, and you just, as you were saying, you know, just sort of give them a little bit of extra perspective on it. Do you realize that the Malayo is extinct almost everywhere else? And if we keep doing this, 20 years from now, it's going to be gone here as well. Is that what we want? It's just an invitation.
Did you know at the time you were having those early conversations that there was this deep taproot to be drawn upon called love of nature? Because a lot of times when you hear about conservation initiatives, it's all facts and figures, and this is dying, and this has to happen and all. But conversation about love, care, deep connection, it's not necessarily the first thing that you heard.
It's right.
And when you talked to VCA, I was so moved by the fact that you could tap into that and then bring the science and then bring in the what to do's. But did you know that at the start of your journey?
I knew it in my gut, but it was definitely not part of my formal education in conservation. Quite the reverse, in fact. And still to this day, if you read the scientific papers or you take classes in how to convince people to care about conservation, they will advise you to talk about economic benefits that people gain from having biodiversity, or you know, the medicines that are out there in the forest, or the ecosystem services that make the rest of nature useful to humans. So that was what had been instilled in me in my academic and in my prior career professionally. But I'm a nature lover, and I knew that wasn't why I was there. I was there because I love nature. And I knew that there were other people who felt that way too. And so I think for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, I just wanted to speak to that on some level, as well as, you know, not to the complete exclusion of those other ways in which other parts of nature can be useful to us, but certainly not for me. Those are not why it's good for me is not what's most important about nature for me.
Well, what's interesting to me, because I didn't know about your first bachelor's degree from Harvard. Mm-hmm. It was a comparative religion. Do you remember that, right? Well, you must have had some construct for thinking about soul and spirit, you know. And so how interesting that you had that piece, and then you could bring in the science and the conservation. Because if you start out without that piece, as if it's just numbers and economics and all, you come to a different conclusion. But when you know that people are often led by a quest for meaning or something more, it will probably orient you. Did you feel informed by?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, both from my own personal experience and from, you know, that background and just sort of where I come from, I think I felt that, all of the world's major religions teach that the planet, the rest of nature, does not belong to humans. It belongs to God in whatever, you know, and all the different religions define God a little bit differently, and there are all kinds of of different shades of that. But there is no religion that says humanity is the center of the universe. No, that's not how it works. And even people who don't profess to have a religion, my experience is that almost everybody likes to think of themselves as part of something that's bigger. And we're all looking for meaning and how we fit into that bigger whole. So I guess that being very precious to me and knowing how universal that is in the human experience, that's what, you know, and there I was in a different culture where, you know, different languages and different customs and all kinds of things like that. But there are certain human universal things that allow us to connect with one another on a deeper level that don't depend on language and culture and all of those things. And that's my favorite place to relate to people. So oh,
I'm just in relative awe about that, because having worked in an NGO myself, you know, with a lot of caring people, it's just, I know what conversations people usually aren't having. And so to have you bring that living understanding into the work that you were doing really set you on a different path. And so take us back. You're working, you're a senior scientist. You have a gathering of people who are asking you. You've opened our eyes. Tell us what to do. We need help. But you also have two kids at the time, mm-hmm. and you have to make a living, and you have a, I would assume, relatively high status, stable income with the Nature Conservancy. What was that like to consider making a transition from that way of life?
Well, I would like to be able to tell you that I just marched out and said, this is my calling, and I'm going to follow this calling no matter what it takes. No, that's not the way it happened. So I started, while I was still working for TNC, I started conversations with these folks, and it was, you know, on an occasional level and that kind of thing. Well, at the same time, some other things started happening within the Nature Conservancy, which at the time were not comfortable or happy, and there was kind of a shakeup, and they decided that that all of the non-Indonesian staff were going to be fired, basically. They wanted, for good reasons, the sentiment behind it was, I appreciate where that was coming from. They wanted to, you know, get rid of their foreign staff, have a more Indonesian-led program. So I was given my notice and told, you know, your job here is going to end at such and such a time. And by the way, I should say that the conversations that I was having with those folks in Tompotika were a style of conservation that TNC did not do. So there was never a time when TNC was interested in being part of this project. So I always knew I did all that stuff on my own time anyway. And then I learned that, you know, my job was ending and I wasn't going to have a job. And so what was I going to do? I was going to go back to Vashon, probably. I did have some other opportunities to stay in Indonesia working on other stuff, but I wanted to come home to Vashon. So we did that. And I was looking for jobs, you know, for a period of months, maybe as much as a year. I was looking for the next professional job that would give me health insurance and a stable income for my kids. The right thing just didn't come along. Well, meanwhile, I was still having these conversations with people in Tompotika. And we got to a point where basically there was stuff to be done with that. And concurrently, as this wonderful island would have it, a group had kind of formed here to support this work. And I'd given a talk at Vashon Audubon in 2005. And I sort of closed that talk by saying, you know, there's a village in Indonesia that's asked for help. And if we want to help them prevent the extinction of this bird, they'd be glad of that. And a whole bunch of people came up after that and said, yeah, sign me up. This is Vashon. So people came up. And so we were getting things going there. And I realized that there was work to be done. There wasn't any money behind it, but if I could somehow just help that work get done, that then we would see. But it seemed like that work needed to get done. So we organized a fundraiser here and raised enough money to start that project. And I was still volunteering my time, and I realized that all I really needed to do then was to just survive, and, you know, feed the kids and such. And luckily, because I am a single mom, or I was a single mom, and I lived very close to the bone for a long time, I'm not afraid of that. And so I knew what I needed to survive, and I felt more free, I think, to just do what I needed to do to survive for however long that would take. And so I did odd jobs for a couple of years, where I was doing gardening and house cleaning and construction and whatever people needed help with. And that was just what I did to earn the money while we were getting this up and running.
Although I want to underscore that, because on our island, there are a lot of people are doing patchwork jobs because they have a dream. They want to do their own creative work. They feel a calling. And it doesn't necessarily sync up with earning a living.
Right.
But the calling is stronger, and they figure out a way to patch it together. So I think that is an incredible skill.
It was great. And I was part of this community of people where, you know, we sort of, there is kind of a community, and some, you know, someone is needing their house painted. And so, you know, there are five or six of us who are all doing odd jobs at this time. And we go to that house, and we would be working on it for a week or two, and then it would be done. And then, you know, you would pass along to each other word of other jobs that needed to be done. And everybody would work out when they could be available, because, as you say, everybody was doing other things as well.
And so, in a sense, it was very community-based.
Yeah, you're
know?
Right.
Like you work right. in the community over there, but you also made it work here. To
yeah,
be able to get that.
Right. And, you know, there were people who knew that I needed work and said, come work in our garden every week. And mm-hmm. so that was fantastic for me. So I knew at least every week I had 4 hours of gardening work to do.
Do you take a special pill that keeps you immune from fear? Because, you know, a lot of us would say, yeah, I want to do that. I will do that. But then there are those moments. You get tired, you know, you get flu, whatever happens, and all of a sudden fear sneaks in, saying, what the heck are you doing? How are you going to make this work? What do you think? You know, that kind of stuff. Were you able to just kind of ride through it, or were there times when you really had to wrestle with it?
Well, it isn't always comfortable, for sure. But, you know, my dad used to say, let it ride. And so, you know, when you feel depressed or you feel fearful or things aren't going so well, you just let it ride for a little while and things pass.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. Yeah. Because a lot of people go down in those kinds of waves. You know?
Yeah.
Or they want to know how it's all going to work out. And I know I'm guilty of that at times. I want the promise, but the kind of thing that you're doing, and the true social entrepreneurship, doesn't come with a promise. Comes with a possibility, but no promise.
That is certainly the case. I guess one other thing, though, now that you mention it, Sally, is for me, and I'm a religious person, and for me, if I can talk about it in terms of God. I don't think God asks us or promises us outcomes. God doesn't want us to try to control the outcomes. God just asks us to show up and do our best. And so for me, if I feel like I'm on the path I'm supposed to be on and I'm doing what I can there, then I can let go of whatever the outcome is going to be, because that's not where my prize is. That's not where the meaning is. The meaning is in the doing. It's in the trying. It's in the show up and do what you can. It's not whether you succeed or not in the end, because that's out of your hands anyway.
That sounds like such an important lesson for anybody who's going to do significant environmental work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're in the conservation world, oh my goodness, if you're too focused on outcomes, you curl up in a whimpering heap before long because there's so many losses and you're just dealing with loss all the time. It's all around us. And so you can't be too focused on the outcomes. You just have to find that, you know, you can call it process or you can call it the path or you can call it whatever. But for me, that's where the real juice is in discerning, what am I supposed to do? What's my role in this big picture? And what's our role? You know, how are we? It's those pieces. Those are the only parts that you can really control.
If you can even control them.
Indeed.
Yeah. But I do love that. And it was part of what I loved about your talk was the sense that, saving the Malayo bird isn't necessarily saving the world, but it's doing the small part that's before you to do. And to know that you can take ground, you know, not always, not promised, but you can take ground. That was a very inspirational message, because I think a lot of us are in despair about the enormity of everything. And you go, I can't fix this. I can't fix that. I can't fix this. And then soon you're in a heap.
Yeah.
But to be able to say, yes, but today this is the thing that's in front of me. This is being asked of me. This I can do. And holding onto that with your faith and your will, that's such a powerful combo.
That's all any of us can do, really, isn't it? You know, is just the thing that is there before us to do today.
And yes, although, you know, our culture breeds a lot of aspirations mm-hmm. around success, or do this, and you'll be able to get this. And you will be successful in life if you check these three boxes or have this much income or have this big house or whatever. And here's the road to being able to do it. I mean, when I speak like that, it sounds like nonsense. But I think culturally, it's kind of embedded.
Right. Yeah. I never imagined that we would start a whole new nonprofit organization and do this. It was just sort of one step leading to the next and the way opening. It really feels to me in many ways like this whole project and the Malayo's recovery and everything, that all had and has a life of its own. I'm just along for the ride. And it's a great ride. You know, I sort of, you say, okay, well, here's the situation. What can we do here? Well, maybe we can do this. Okay, let's try that. Tweak. And then let's see what happens. Oh, that's cool. All right. And then you go up to the next thing. Oh, that was a miserable failure. Okay. But you sort of go along and all of those little tweakings are just little things that you might or might not be able to do, and you have to let go of what that outcome is going to be and just be ready to take the next step, whatever that is.
Did you become executive director at some point? Was that your role?
Yeah.
As the organization matured, they needed more leadership. They were able to pay you enough to survive on. And,
yes.
Yeah. And then you took on the weight of being fundraiser and then helping on the ground as well.
Well, it's, you know, we're a very small organization. And for a long time, I was the sole person here in the U.S., outside of Indonesia, who was doing fundraising and doing grant writing and sort of, you know, reporting to the world on what was happening here and trying to raise awareness about it. And the lucky thing was that we did have almost instant success where, guess what? You know, once you stop taking all their eggs, the Malayos recover. You know, what we learned was this isn't always the case by any means, but in this case, it was. In this case, when we humans stopped the thing that we were doing that was the killer threat to those Malayos, which was we were taking all their eggs, when we stopped that, that's all we did. Stopped taking the eggs, protected what was left of the habitat. We didn't do anything else. We didn't have to interfere with, we didn't have to move the eggs, we didn't have to do anything, just stop messing with them. And nature took care of the rest. Nature is very resilient. And fortunately, in this case, what was so wonderful was that people agreed, local people down there, once invited to remember their connection with this bird and invited to realize what the effects of our human behavior was on this bird, people were willing to stop. You know, we basically said, you know, we've just got to stop taking their eggs. And people said, okay. You know, they as it happened, it turned out to be a win-win for everybody because we hired the people who used to poach eggs, who used to take the eggs and sell them. We hired those people as guards to participate in guarding the nesting ground. And the number of eggs that had dwindled so low by then anyway, that they were earning more money being paid to guard for a day than they could have earned by selling an egg if they'd gotten one. So everybody was willing in that point. And it you know, that worked out. That was that money that was raised on Vashon Island to pay those people. Yeah. And that was great. And then it kind of went from there because the birds almost instantly recovered. There was success. Grantors love success. So we could write grants that say, hey, you know, the bird is recovering. And that made us able to raise more funds to keep the thing going. Mm-hmm. And eventually for me to get paid.
Did you have skills in community organizing going in, or was this an on-the-job training for you?
Well, I'd been mayor of my town, so I had worked with controversy. I'd worked with different groups of people. So I had done that. I come from a Quaker background where we do a lot with building consensus. And so I had that, but no, I didn't have formal skills in it. We were all just doing the best we can. And Indonesians have often a lot of respect for group process and for taking the time and letting people hearing what people have to say and deliberating sometimes, you know, for days and days and days until you can all come together. So that was a very natural thing in that case, it was one village that we were trying to get a decision. And so that worked.
The other aspect of the community work that I was so interested in was how the communities used music and art and theater to engage people. Was that there from the start, or is that something that got
We brought that.
You brought that?
Yeah, we brought that. They thought it was novel and amusing.
Really?
At first.
Uh-huh.
But it has since become a real favorite.
What was the first part of that that you brought?
Well, I think our first Art for Conservation project actually was one that we did with Vashon artist Sandra Noel, who we brought down to Indonesia and organized. We asked the local high schools to send us a dozen of their best, most talented high school artists, and we brought them to a village for a week, and Sandra gave them a workshop in how to draw and paint from nature. So we took them out into the woods and we showed them wildlife, their own wildlife that lives right there in the woods behind their house, most of which they were not familiar with. But we brought in photos, and Sandy came in and taught them, here's how you draw leaves, here's how you draw fur. And she did a great job. And these kids discovered that, oh, this is really fun. I love to draw, and now I can draw animals. And here's this really cool wildlife creature that only lives here in Sulawesi, nowhere else in the whole world. And I can draw it, and I can be proud of it. And then we took those drawings that they did, and we made them into a calendar, and we gave them out for free all over Tompatika so that people could be really proud of what their kids had created of their wildlife. And so it was just like this wonderful feel-good thing where everybody loved what they were learning about their wildlife, and the kids loved what they were creating and what they were coming into, and it like opened their eyes to the nature around them in a whole new way, because they hadn't, again, they'd sort of thought of it as their wallpaper for the most part. And now suddenly it was something that they could really connect to as a way of expressing.
So inspired.
And that was such a wonderful project for everybody involved that we thought, let's do more of this. So we just started doing different kinds of art for conservation programs. And now we have, every 2 years, a whole festival where we have drama and art and music and community events and everything. And it's a huge 3 week long thing. And it's a great way to reach everybody in the community. We go out and we go into the schools and we do education programs in the schools, which is great. And the kids love it, but that doesn't necessarily get everybody in the community. And in a lot of cases, if you've got poaching going on, for example, it's probably mostly adult men who are involved in that. And a lot of them may not even know that the animals, the wildlife that they're killing is actually legally protected and what they're doing is illegal. So you have to somehow try to reach them. The arts is a great way to do that. It's non-threatening. It's positive. You invite them to come to a show and they watch a drama. And the bad guys are like this, and the good guys are,
and nobody's lecturing at
exactly.
them.
Yeah. And it's just fun, yeah. And everybody loves it. And so it's a great way to get the message out.
I could imagine that others in the NGO world would be looking at what you're doing and saying, I think we have something we could learn from this. Are they coming to you and saying, you have a unique approach or a very original approach to community development, incorporating the arts, the way that you've worked with people? Are they coming to learn?
Everybody says, wow, that's really cool. and it's very fun. I think one of the challenges is, and we've certainly experienced this, it's next to impossible to get funding for specifically these kinds of art for conservation programs. Because in the conservation world, they're very oriented towards measures of success. And it's very difficult to measure the impact of how you are changing hearts and minds by letting people watch a drama. And where we're out at in the scientific community right now, there's fashions in science just as there are in everything else. And right now it's very heavily towards the metrics. And if you don't know how to measure it, then it's not important. And so because like having a festival for 3 weeks where everybody in the community comes, but you can't really gauge very easily what kind of, quote, impact it has had on changing their behavior or changing their understanding of things, it means that it's very difficult to get funding specifically for these kinds of projects. So we have to sort of, we write grants to get funding for things like our Maleo program, which is now, you know, beautifully recovering the Maleo. And so we can get funding for that. So then if we go and raise funds from private donors, those funds are usually not restricted to a particular thing. So we squirrel those funds away for art and for things like that that are harder to get hard funding for. And so we've been lucky to be able to keep doing it. But it's sort of like, you know, art and music programs in the schools. It's the sort of stuff that it's the poor cousin that doesn't get funding where, you know, science and math is measurable. And so that does get funding. And we're all about that in our society right now.
I hear you. I'm a little disappointed because I know there are so many groups and that really know the power of performance arts, art, music as tools for change. And they have documented it all around the world. And so it's kind of like, wake up, conservation community. Wake up, scientists. This is not rocket science. There's a lot of evidence, although a lot of it could be anecdotal. You can't run it through your regressions, you know, and come up with a number. But the evidence is there.
It's not that there is no evidence, but it's one of those things where when people are coming from a place of feeling, there's just not enough, you know, am I going to pay for, you know, a dozen GPS units so that team can go and, you know where they are around, you know, those kinds of things tend to be much more favored in terms of conservation funding than something that's kind of mushy and, you know, because, and again, we've been working in Tompatika now for, well, since 2006, so 18 years. And that is unusual to make a commitment to one place for the long term. And a lot of the things that we're doing there have taken years before you really start to see really deep changes. And that, for me, is part of the joy of it. But that's also not the way the funding world usually works. They don't want to wait 18 years to see results. You know, grantors want to see what are your deliverables within a 2 or 3 year grant cycle. And again, arts and things like that, you might be able to show them a pretty picture, but oh, well, you know, people's hearts are really different from how they were 18 years ago. That's very
difficult. Mushy.
It's very mushy.
It's mushy. And yet I keep hoping that we're at a point where we know that that may be the only thing that drives real change.
That's what I think. That's what you think, Sally, you know, and we're lucky enough that we've been able to keep going sort of, you know, on the fly like this as best as we can. But it's not the standard. If we were pressed about it by a skeptic, it would be difficult for us to prove the value, the quote value, of the money that we spend for the arts and that kind of thing. So
I hear you. It's still uphill. Still uphill, even though I like to think that we are at the beginning of a kind of change in consciousness. It is the beginning. We are not there yet, even though it's probably that kind of change that we're going to have to undergo to be able to address the magnitude of what we're talking about with environmental damage. What are you going to do with your PhD? Are you going to be able to bring in any of these themes into what you'll be writing about, what you'll be researching about?
Well, you know, I'm doing this PhD because when we got into doing this Maleo work, we realized that there almost no research had been done on some of the really basic fundamental biological and ecological matters to do with the Maleo. We really needed to know these things. And looking around, who's qualified to do this? Who's in it? Well, it sort of turned out to be me. And I had not expected to do this. But it has turned out to be really super useful and super fun to do this research. The research itself is quite nuts and bolts science stuff that needs to be known about the Maleo and, you know, the status of the Maleo all over its range, what's causing the decline, you know, what different things about the biology, you know, those kinds of things. So the PhD itself will not delve into these kind of favorite things of mine. But our work in Aalto has no such constraints. So, you know, we've had a great time being able to already incorporate, you know, for example, we talk about our approach for Maleo conservation, not just for Maleo conservation, but for all the wildlife that we work with there, is what we now have termed a respect for nature approach. And that goes to, it's a bit of a contrast with what are often sort of the more conventional approaches to conservation in that part of the world where, for example, every other Maleo program other than ours digs up the Maleo eggs, builds a hatchery, puts them in a hatchery. It's a much more sort of interventionist kind of approach. We feel that sometimes intervention is necessary, but often it isn't, and that we should ask ourselves, we humans, very carefully before we intervene, whether it's really necessary. And is there a way that we can respect nature in our approach to conservation here and try to mimic nature as far as possible. And again, like we did with our first nesting ground, just remove the problem that the humans are causing. And maybe just by removing that problem, nature will take care of the rest. So we use that approach, that respect for nature approach, and we talk about it that way, and we explain what we mean by that, because it's a new way of thinking for people in Indonesia. We also, in our outreach, as we've just been talking, we use unashamedly people's love for nature as a way to get at them.
I heard that in the talk. It was brilliant.
I could imagine that when you have the PhD behind your name, you will have credibility, not just because you have the numbers and you've done the counting and the science, but, you know, at a certain point, people just say, hey, she's in the club now.
You're right.
We'll listen to her a little differently because she's in the club. And I hope you can use that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, I feel like I'm in the luckiest possible position now, Sally, because that is true. You know, hopefully in a year or so from now, I will get my PhD. I'll have those numbers, those letters after my name, and that will give me that extra little bit of credibility. But also, I just turned 60, and you know what? I don't have to care about those things that used to worry so much when I was younger. I don't have to worry about a career. There's nothing that I need in my life. I'm just sitting pretty because I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing. I don't have to worry about how it might affect my future career or what people will think of me.
It's one of the secrets of getting older that can compensate in many ways for the things that we lose.
Yeah.
To be able to say, I don't have to prove myself.
Right.
You know, I came up through a social science background and numbers and quantitative analysis and all that, where speaking about soul and spirit was kind of verboten. You know, it would be red penned out and you go, come on, guys. You know, I could show you in a moment. We know that people respond. We know that people search for meaning. We know that people care. We know that that makes a difference when people are together. We know that music moves the mind. We know all this stuff, and, you know, science is slow to catch up.
You know, 6 months ago, I was giving a talk at a global gathering for scientists, and I was talking about Maleo. I gave my graphs and my charts and all my good science stuff, and then I started talking about love, and I saw these guys in the front row, you know, the minute I started talking about love, and I saw them start to squirm and start to slouch down in their chairs. And, you know, they clearly were super uncomfortable as I realized at that time, it's okay. You know, when I was younger, it would have worried me that those guys did not want to hear, exactly, that they didn't want to hear it. And now I can just say, that's okay. You don't have to like this. I have to say this.
You do.
And as it turned out, after that talk, quite a few people came up and said, thank you for talking. That's what we needed to hear. So, you know, some are going to like it, some are not. And that's okay. It doesn't matter. It's what I have to say. So, you know.
It's what you have to say. And also when you look out to the environmentalists like Joanna Macy or the Jane Goodalls, you go, they're fueling on love.
Yeah, yeah, right, right.
They
right.
couldn't make it to 90 doing the work that they'd done.
Right.
They're running on high octane, and so let's just acknowledge that. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
How much longer are you still ED of Topatika?
Yes.
And do you see that for the foreseeable future, or do you see, or
for
you
a
just
while,
don't know?
You know, sometime in the next decade, I will pass it off to someone else, I expect. There's still a lot of stuff going on. We're still really involved in, you know, new challenges, new things come up all the time. So it still feels very vital. I still feel very energized about doing this work.
How much time do you spend? Well, how do you split your life between Vashon and Indonesia?
Before COVID, I used to go 3 or 4 times a year to Indonesia. Nowadays, since COVID, it's just been twice. And that's nice and good. And our team down there is great. We're working really hard on building that team. And so right now, you know, twice a year is that's a very good, seems like a good balance. They always love it when I come because I always bring new things and new trainings and stuff. But it's also better for me to not be there too much. So it's working well. It's evolving in the way I think it needs to. So,
well, I am so impressed that you have played the long haul. You know, in a land where people stay in their jobs for 2 years, you've been fueled. You've been fueled and called to do something that's taken you decades and will continue. And when I talk about creativity, that's, you know, part of this program, I look at that and I say, that is the creative life. You're shaping it to do the thing that calls you. And you've done that for quite a while. So again, I said you're an island hero. You are for me. And I just applaud your work. And I hope that others out there will turn away from the metrics for long enough to see what's really happening, because it's so powerful. And metrics are great. We need them, but we need the love.
And yes, thank you, Sally. And I want to reinforce that. I was speaking to a group of students a year or so ago, you know, graduate students in conservation biology in my field, and I talked to them about releasing our grasp on outcomes a little bit, which is so not what their funders or their, you know, world around them is going to encourage them to do. But I just really wanted to give them a little bit of encouragement to follow the love that is carrying them into this work and follow what is fueling them and not just what they think is, you know, going to be sellable or going to, you know, the more you grasp onto outcomes, which are really not in your control anyway, the harder it is to, the quicker you burn out, the harder it is to feel grounded, like you can keep going no matter what happens. All of that just gets harder. And we don't teach that nowadays. And again, you know, so many of those students came to me afterward and said, thank you for saying this, because, you know, I'm just about burning out and I don't, you know, I'm working on a project where my ecosystem that I've been studying is going downhill and I can't find any good outcomes. So I feel like I should just give up. But that's not why she was there. She wasn't there because she thought she was magically going to turn around that whole ecosystem and it was all be better. She was there because she needed to be there and she needed to be part of that, even if it was going down. She needed to do what she can. And so, you know, she needed affirmation that what she was doing and that role she was playing was enough and that was good and that was an honorable and worthy calling, even if it didn't fix the whole thing.
Wow. I could go on way past my allocated time here because I love what you're talking about. If people have questions or want to connect with you or want to donate, which would be a lovely thing to Topachika, how can they reach you?
Yes, thanks for asking. And yes, we have a newsletter that we send out. We would love to send folks the newsletter. So the easiest way is to just go to our website, which is tompotika.org. T-O-M, like the man's name, P-O-T-I-K-A, tompotika.org. And there's more information there. There's a yellow donate button you can click. There's ways to contact me.
Great.
Yeah, it's all there.
And we'll also have that on the show notes for this show on Voice of Vashon. So thank you so much for your time. I'm leaving inspired today, and I just applaud your work.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure, Sally. I feel like we could just go on forever. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show.
I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.